Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. This Week in America online at thisweekinamerica.us. Forbidden love, deceit, tragedy, action, adventure, danger, captivating characters, all in John Henry Hardy's The Place Where the Giant Fell, a romance historical novel about prejudice in pre-statehood Arizona. An ambitious judge sacrifices life and love, maneuvering people like chess pieces to pursue his goal of becoming governor of Arizona and then president of the United States. John is a Marine Corps veteran more than 33 years, first as an artilleryman, then a military policeman. As a public affairs officer, he wrote numerous newspaper and magazine articles, several winning Freedoms Foundation awards. Recalled to active duty in 1994, served until he was forced to retire because of age, a bachelor's degree in psychology from Rutgers, a master's in business management from the University of Phoenix. John's retired AT&T territorial support manager. John is the author of several novels, including Whisper in My Ear, a romance historical story of the Vietnam War, When Brothers Meet, a romance historical premonition of what would happen to the U.S. and the rest of the globe if China continues the quest of controlling the world's oil supply, and The Day God Played Baseball, a fictional account of a small-town bully who wants to dominate the county's Little League Baseball title, even if he has to cheat to do so. And author of The Place Where the Giant Fell, John Henry Hardy, back with us on This Week in America. John, welcome back to the program. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Rich. It's an honor and a privilege to be here.
You are such a talented writer. It's fun when I have you on because I get to read your books then. And the only problem with that is I don't get any sleep because once I start, it's hard to put a John Henry Hardy book down. You just start reading and really enjoying this. And I love the book we're talking about today, The Place Where the Giant Fell. Let's go back to 1912, Goldfield, Arizona. First of all, let me ask, where did this idea come from? We talked before about your book, Whisper in My Ear, the Vietnam War. Where did this idea come from?
You know, Rick, I moved to Arizona in 1980 into a small town called Paradise Valley. And I was in the Marine Corps Reserve at the time, so I had to stay in good shape, and I still tried to do that. But I used to go jogging every morning around 5:15, and I used to pass this house that had a humongous saguaro cactus on the front lawn. I call it a lawn. I get corrected all the time. This is not a lawn. This is the grass there, but I call it a lawn anyway. And anyway, it rained one night, and it was a thunderstorm, lightning, rain. And when I went jogging the next morning and I passed this house, I saw that the cactus had either been struck by lightning or the wind blew it over, and it fell down on this front lawn, and it broke, and the arms all broke off of it. And so thereafter, whenever I went by that house, I called it the place where the giant fell. And in my mind, something said to me, hey, you know, that might be a title for a story. Coming from New Jersey, the East Coast and Pennsylvania, I never really saw or got acquainted with people who were of Mexican descent. I never ate in a Mexican restaurant. I never tasted a taco or a quesadilla. And if you would ask me what they were, I wouldn't know. And so when I moved to Arizona, I realized how different the flora and the fauna are. And as I got to know of the Mexican people and recalled my history of the Mexican War, I realized that there was a lot of prejudice in pre-statehood Arizona, as there was across Texas, New Mexico, and parts of California. And I said to myself, I'm going to take that title and I'm going to turn it into a book that's a tribute to the Mexican heritage of the United States. And one of the things I wanted to mention in the book was the Treaty of Hidalgo, because a lot of Americans and Mexicans didn't realize that the United States did not just go to war to Mexico to steal the land from them. They also went because of the Alamo and the deaths that had occurred there. And when the war was over, they had several stipulations that were favorable to the Mexicans. One is that they gave the Mexican government $15 million for the land that was ceded to them. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of money in today's environment. But back in 1849, that was a heck of a lot of money.
Yes.
And also, by the Treaty of Hidalgo, it stipulated that any Mexican who still lived within the ceded territory, if they wanted to, could become an American citizen, or they could move back to Mexico. Some of the citizens did move back to Mexico, but many of them stayed here in Arizona. And the part of the basis of this book, The Place Where the Giant Fell, is the fact that a lot of the Mexicans had lived here for generations and generations, and the land that they received and the ranchos they had were the result of Spanish land grants. So they really didn't have a lot of paperwork to back up the fact that they lived on the land for generations and that they owned it. In an American court of law, you have to have some kind of a written document like a deed to a property or a home that says you are the owner. A lot of the Mexicans didn't have that. Consequently, it was rather easy to deceive them and to cheat them out of their land or to buy it at a bargain price. And that is how a lot of the big ranches in Arizona came into being. A lot of the ranch owners who hired guns ranchers, cowboys, had a lot of power. The more men you hired, the more guns you had, the more power you had. And in this story, I focus on that, on the man named Chester Remington, who cheated a lot of people out of their land or frightened them off of it, or simply made the owner disappear if they refused to sell. And that was one of the things that struck me when I read about the history of the Mexican War.
Yeah, he is one of the many characters in the book, and you do such an excellent job of giving us information, a lot of backstory on these characters. And you talk about the research. It was one review talked about the factual references, obviously done a lot of research. This was like going to a history class for you, I'm assuming, as you were preparing to get this exactly right, what it was like in Arizona in 1912.
Yes, Rick. What I tried to do, Rick, is I tried to present the historical facts. I love to do historical novels, but I wanted to put the historical facts out there, but I wanted to put it into a kind of a reading that would keep the person interested in the story and learn the facts, because very few people, once they get out of school, ever go back and read a history book. And so by making it entertaining, I was hoping entertaining,
yes,
and presenting the facts, the people would absorb what actually things were like back in pre-statehood Arizona and somewhat after statehood also.
We'll get into the storyline. Our guest on the program is John Henry Hardy, back with us on the show. The book we're talking about is The Place Where the Giant Fell. His website is jhhardy.com. You'll get all the information there on the book. You can link on directly by going to our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Book available, of course, where books are usually sold. That's John's website. A lot of great information there. A well site, well done. And you can link on directly by going to our website. Let's talk about the judge. I mentioned him, Judge Horace Benton. I mentioned that he maneuvers people like chess pieces. He's really got a goal in mind, several goals in mind, and he's not going to let anything get in his way, is he?
No. In fact, he's a very ambitious man. He is a federal judge in charge of the Arizona territory, because it's not a state yet. And what he wants to do, he wants to be president of the United States. But in order to do that, he's not that well known as a federal judge. But what would happen if he became governor of the state of Arizona, when it became a state, it would greatly enhance his reputation, and it would make it easier for him to slide in the slot of being the governor. However, to do that, he needs the backing and the money of the elites in the Arizona territory. And Chester Remington, who owns the Caballo del Tinto Ranch, which he means the Red Horse Ranch, has a lot of money. But he procured the ownership of his ranch by frightening people off their land, giving them, below subpar value for the land, or he simply made some of the ranchers disappear by killing them and by murder. And that's the way things were done in the West in the old days. There was a lot of murders that took place and a lot of dishonesty. But as the material of the territory began to materialize into a government that was regulated by laws, some of those things had to change. and a change for Chester Remington. But unfortunately, he had already done most of his dirty work and had the largest ranch in Arizona at the time. And so that was part of the history of Arizona. And I tried to put that into a readable material.
And if you've never been to Arizona, you get this graphic picture. You do such a nice job of painting the scenery there. So as we're reading it, we can exactly visualize what's happening in the terrain and what it was like at the time. Mention the judge. Talk about his daughter, who's a main character in the book. That's part of the forbidden love that I was talking about. Part of his master plan, he sort of has someone suitable for her in his mind lined up, but that's not who she's really falling in love with, is it?
No. You know, Carrie Ann Benton, one of the chief characters in the story, her mom died when she was two. And so her father hired a Mexican woman to take care of Carrie and to raise her. So Carrie grew up with the love and affection of a stepmother who was Mexican. Now, the father, this Judge Benton, is a racist, obviously, but he's also a hypocrite. And sooner or later, he takes this woman and she becomes not only his caretaker for his daughter, but also his lover. And he pretends that he really loves her, but he really doesn't. The person he loves the most is Judge Horace Benton. And so over the years, he had promised to marry Maria Alvarez, which is the stepmom's name, but he never lives up to his promise. He wants to fulfill his ambitions of being governor and then president. And he doesn't care about anybody else except his daughter. His daughter is the one person other than himself that he does love. And so she doesn't think anything about it. So to her, a person who is a Mexican, it's just like everybody else, the white people. She doesn't even think about that person's a Mexican. She just takes it for granted that they're a human being, and she gets along well with them. So she is totally different than her dad is. Her dad is ambitious. He doesn't care about anyone else but himself, but he needs people to get him into position to be governor. And so he becomes a compatriot of the elite in the states. And when he throws a party, they're the people that he votes in. He votes into people into the territorial legislature. He invites in anybody who's of any significance in the state. And that's how he plans to make his reputation.
In one of the main characters is Earl Remington. Talk about him and the connection, because as you mentioned, the judge really needs to have the affluent people. He needs their votes, support. He needs their money. He's got Earl in mind for his daughter.
Yes, indeed. He wants his daughter to be proud of him. Like I said, she's the only one that he really loves other than himself. And so Earl Remington is the son of Chester Remington, who owns the largest ranch in Arizona at the time. And Earl, in school where he meets Carrie Ann Benton, he makes it well known and he keeps reminding people that his dad is wealthy, that he is powerful, and he doesn't let anybody forget that. Problem with him is he's kind of sweet on Carrie Ann Benton. But Carrie Ann Benton is not sweet on him. She doesn't like him, in fact, because he's a bragger. And he's always, he doesn't like other people of other races. One of the reasons why is because his dad, when he was growing up, ran a lot of people off of their land in order to acquire it. So the Benton boy, Remington boy, he grows up not liking Mexicans either, just like his dad. And that's where he gets his prejudice from. It's kind of like in a line of heredity that doesn't like these people of other races. And his father doesn't like the Indians either. His father, because he had to fight the Indians to stay on the land, because the Indians were occupying this land even when the Spaniards first came here, and Coronado explored Arizona and all the way up into Colorado and into Kansas. So the prejudice against Indians dates way, way back into our history.
And Carrie has her own boyfriend, right? Someone that she's really been attached to from an early age, but that's not good enough for Dad.
No, she's in love with a boy named Rodney Bouchard. Rodney Bouchard's father is a French-Canadian, and his mother is Mexican. But, of course, Judge Benton, he doesn't want to have anything to do with the Mexicans. One of the reasons is that he figures Mexicans aren't going to be interested in the government and they're not going to vote anyway. The white elite people and the other white people in the state are the ones who are going to do the voting. So he is the one they're mainly concerned about. The problem there is that later on in the story, the Mexican people do go to the polls and they do vote. And another problem that he has that he hadn't figured on, what there is other people who were prominent in the Arizona Territory Legislature that are more well-known than he is, even though he's the federal judge for the district. And that's the problem that he runs into.
The book is called The Place Where the Giant Fell. John Henry Hardy is the author. His website is jhhardy.com. Book, of course, available wherever books are sold. You can link on directly to John's website by going to our website, thisweekinamerica.us. While there, you'll see not only information on The Place Where the Giant Fell, but John's other books as well. Rapidly running out of time on the program, it's so interesting, the characters you have, and again, I go back to the development. Talk about the process in writing this book, of coming up with these very rich characters. Sometimes people will insert characters, and it's like, okay, they need eight people, and they've got seven, so they're just dropping somebody in. All yours are very important to the story. Talk about developing these characters and weaving all of them into the storyline, because you've got every element I mentioned in the beginning. You've got a little bit of everything in this story.
Yes, indeed. And one of the things I wanted to do as a tribute to the Mexican people who stayed in the United States and decided to become citizens was their service in World War I. A lot of the Mexicans fought in the American Army in World War I. A lot of people don't know that, in spite of the treatment they were getting back by people like Horace Benton. But Horace Benton was determined that he was going to get rid of this kid, Rodney Bouchard, because he knew his daughter loved him. And he dupes Earl Remington into doing that, to try to do away with Rodney Bouchard. He tried it once before with a man named Oliver Draper, and he paid Oliver, who was kind of a character who was always in trouble with the law, but he knew Judge Benton, and Judge Benton was kind of looked over a lot of things that Oliver Draper did. They weren't friends because Oliver Draper was not influential in the state. So he paid him $100 to get rid of Rodney Bouchard. And Rodney and Carrie are forbidden by her father to see each other. So Rodney introduces her to a hideaway in a place called Fire Mountain. And Fire Mountain has an alcove that can be accessed via a tunnel. The tunnel is hidden between two large rocks. And Carrie and Rodney meet there. They have a fireplace there, a circle of fire. He puts flat stones in there for them to set on. They roast marshmallows and hot dogs. And in that alcove, that one side is open to the western side of the mountain, is a humongous cactus. It's about 60 feet high, and it has a lot of arms on it and holes that were made by woodpeckers, where owls now develop their family. They lay their eggs in there. And so what happens is that was their secret hiding place, and nobody knows about it. So Oliver Draper, who's been hired to kill Rodney Bouchard, he begins following the couple. And he follows him to this mountain, and they go behind these two large stones, and he's thinking they're having sex, and he's going to go over there and catch her having sex. Then what he plans to do is he's going to blackmail her, and if she doesn't take care of him, like she's taking care of this kid Rodney Bouchard, he's got to tell her father. So he gets up between the rocks thinking they're there, and he can't find anything. He can't see anything. So he's kind of puzzled, and he has to leave because somehow they disappeared and he didn't know where they went. Well, he goes back later on and he finally discovers the entrance beneath one of these large rock outcroppings. And there's a tunnel under there, and he crawls inside and he waits. And sure enough, Carrie and Benton shows up. And of course, right away, he's going to do his little thing with her. And she of course, rejects him. And she's standing on the edge of a precipice in the valley between Fire Mountain and another mountain named No-Name Mountain. That's what they call it because nobody ever named it. And she's standing on the precipice, and this guy, this hulking figure, Oliver Draper, is standing over her, and he's angry because she won't have sex with him. And he's saying, "You'll have sex with that half-breed kid, but you won't have sex with a white man like me." Well, at this time, Rodney shows up. And Ronnie said, get away from her. And these two get into a fight. And of course, this guy wants to kill Rodney because he's got paid for it by Carrie's father.
Yes.
And tries to push him over the precipice. And he's just about to push him over the precipice when Carrie picks up a rock from the circle of rocks that they build the fire in, and she hits him in the head with it. And he reaches back and he grabs his skull. And as he does so, he lurches forward. Rodney jumps out of the way, and Oliver Japer falls over the precipice. Well, this is a major development for Rodney and for Carrie Ann Benton. And so they decide not to tell anybody about it. But Rodney looks over the edge, and he sees the body laying down there amongst the rocks, and he knows he's dead. So they scoot out of there. He said, we're not going to come back here for a long time. In the meantime, Mary Ann Japer reports her husband's missing to Marshal Max Greystone, who's the territorial marshal. And they look for him, but they can't find him, have no idea. They'll go over to the hurdy-gurdy house on the other side of town that this guy, Oliver Japer, frequents. And, of course, that's today known as a brothel.
Yes.
And they haven't seen him either because they make a lot of money off of this guy. And so they're kind of sorry to see that he's missing. Well, anyway, eventually a hiking couple discovers Oliver Draper's body, but it's deteriorated. It's stuck down in between the crevice and the rocks. And Max Greystone is called, and he goes over there, and he wants to identify who the body is, and he reaches into the pocket of the skeleton now and pulls out the wallet, and it's Oliver Draper. And inside the wallet is $100. And the first thing the marshal, being a marshal, wonders, where the heck did a guy like this guy get $100 from?
Yes.
And somebody had to pay him because he lived from day to day and his paycheck. Well, anyway, in the long run, it turns out that the marshal is getting suspicious of the judge because of certain things that happens. And then World War I breaks out. Rodney Bouchard is drafted. And Earl Remington, who could avoid the draft because of his father's influence, is talking to the judge, and the judge is promising him that if you get rid of Rodney Bouchard, if the opportunity arises, I'll give you my daughter's hand in marriage. Well, that's to Earl Remington,
yes.
The boy who's used to getting everything that he wants. This is an opportunity, and he joins the army. Consequently, he gets into the same company as Rodney Bouchard. And during the Second Battle of the Marne, he's in the trench with Rodney. The Germans are on the run, and he sees an opportunity to murder Rodney Bouchard, and he does. He shoots him in the back of the head as he's looking over the trench at the retreating troops. Nobody else is in the trench except another wounded doughboy, and he's wounded rather badly. So, Earl Remington says, this guy's going to die. I'll kill Rodney Bouchard first, and then I'll finish the wounded soldier off. So he kills Rodney Bouchard, and he's about to turn the watchman on this wounded man when all of a sudden two medics appear in the trench, knowing that there's a wounded man in there. So they pick him up, put him on a stretcher, and take him out. But, you know, Earl Remington's not worried. This guy's really badly wounded. He's going to die anyway. We get further into the story, and they get home, and Rodney Bouchard is, of course, dead. And this guy, Oliver, is gone. And so Earl Remington is becoming real friendly with the family. He apologizes to Carrie for the inappropriate remakes he made to her over the years.
Yes.
And so Carrie starts to realize she's getting older. Her friends now are married and have children. She's not even married. So she thinks about marrying this guy, Earl Remington, and she decides that's what she's going to do. And so it made her father happy, of course. Problem is... The problem is that Maria Alvarez, the judge has lost his bid for the governorship. He's not going to be the president of the United States. He loses a second term and realizes what he's going to be as a federal judge. And he finally asks Maria Alvarez to marry him. And as it says, I hope you're going to be satisfied just being a judge's wife and not the governor's wife or the president's wife. Well, by this time, Maria had gone disgusted with this man because she knew he didn't love her.
Yes.
And she got acquainted with another guy, a little Italian immigrant by the name of Luigi Giordano. And in Italy, Luigi was a shoemaker. And he migrated to the United States. He became a shoemaker, made the shoes for all the people in town and in the surrounding territory. And he was successful enough to open up an emporium where he sold a lot of other things besides shoes. And Maria Alvarez, when she rejects Judge Benton's bid, even though he bought her a big 2-diamond carat ring, she said, "You don't love me. You've never loved me. You just love yourself more than anybody. I'm going to marry Luigi Giordano." Well, the judge is infuriated because everybody goes to lovers. And he says to her, "You mean you're going to choose that dirty little wop over a federal judge?" And she said, "Yes, I'm going to choose that dirty little wop over a federal judge because he loves me, which you never did." He said, the judge says, "You don't love him. You love me." She said, "I don't love him, but I'm going to marry him because he loves me. And I never had a man in my entire life love me before. And that's good enough for me." Well, the judge, he's just infuriated. And as Maria turns around to finish her packing because she's leaving, the judge gets angry and he shoves her, pushes her forward. She stumbles, hits her head on the corner of the dresser, and it's a fatal injury. She falls to the floor, and the judge is standing there looking. He realizes she's dying. So he takes the diamond ring and he slips it on her finger. So when Judge Benton is called and Dr. Wilshire shows up to pronounce her dead, and he pronounces as an accident, of course, they can't help but notice the ring. Now, the day before, Marshall Greystone had talked to Maria Alvarez, and he didn't notice any ring on her finger, so he's kind of suspicious. And so he says to the judge, "When did you get engaged to Maria Alvarez?" He said, "Yesterday." Well, Marshall knows he's lying because he talked to Maria yesterday. She wasn't wearing the ring, so he's suspicious of the judge. But he can't prove anything until Carrie Benton comes in brokenhearted over this whole thing, but she's going to finish packing her mother's gear, her clothing, and she's going to send it back to her folks back in Mexico. As she's finishing the packing in the bottom drawer, she comes across a letter, and it's addressed to Luigi Giordano. And with that is a note that's folded. And in there, it's a note that says, this is OD. "Judge Benton, how much money would it take for me to get rid of Ronnie Boucher out of your daughter's life forever?" And he signs it OD. He didn't say Ronnie Bouchard. He put RB, which is Ronnie Bouchard's initials. And of course, Carrie immediately knows who he's talking about and realizes that her father is really a murderer and that she murdered the man that she loved. And now Maria's dead. And now she thinks that he killed Maria, and she knows he did it.
Wow.
She's downstairs. She's going to get Marshall Greystone and tell him what happened. And her father walks in the door just as she gets to the bottom of the steps, and he sees she's upset. And he says to her, "What's the matter?" And she said, "You killed the man I love. You killed the only stepmother, the only mother I've ever known." And he said, "It was an accident. I didn't mean to kill her." So, of course, now she knows for sure he's the killer.
Exactly what happened, yes.
So the father saying, she's going to go get Marshall Greystone. So he takes the notes out of her hand and runs over to the fireplace. She's trying to get the notes out of his hand, but of course he's bigger and stronger than she is. And he throws him into the fire, and the evidence is gone. So she no point in calling Marshall Greystone. She has no evidence to prove that her father did it. It would be a federal judge's word against her word.
Yes. Jim, I got about 2 minutes left. So I told you this was going to be a good book, friends. You got to get the book. Got to get the book.
Yeah. And so in the end, she does. She goes away, moves out, never talks to her father again, marries another fine man, raises a family. And when she's 93 years old, when she's younger, her second husband is killed in World War II. He was drafted again, even though he was in the Army in World War I. She goes back to the place where that was their secret hiding place in Fire Mountain. And she goes up into the Fire Mountain. She has all the memories of her first love, Ronnie Bouchard, and the silver star that her husband won. And she has it on her blouse and the canteen that Rodney gave her. She reaches into the old picnic basket and pulls out 3 sticks of dynamite, pushes the cap in, and she very nonchalantly lights the fuse. And she puts it near the tunnel. Then she goes over to the edge of the precipice where Oliver Draper fell over and where he tried to push her love over. And she takes a last look at No Name Mountain. And she's thinking about hoping that she's going to meet her father and her true biological mother and Maria Alvarez in heaven. And while she's looking at, the breeze blows down the canyon and brushes against her face. And it's a familiar breeze. And then everything suddenly disappears. And a state trooper riding down the road, it's a paved road now, before when it used to be a dirt road. He's riding down, he sees the dust column and hears the explosion, and he thinks it's another one of those nuts looking for the lost Dutchman gold mine. But he finds out that it's Carrie Ann Benton's car parked down at the foot of the mountain.
Yes.
But they said it can't possibly be her. She can't possibly, she had cancer, he found out from an investigation, and she wouldn't have any sticks of dynamites anyway, so it wasn't her. So when that thing explodes, it seals Carrie and her memories and the giant cactus in there forever. And, and nobody knows what happened to Carrie. She didn't tell her family she was going to do this. There was something she had to do. And she wrote a note saying, I hope you forgive me. I love you all, but this is something I have to do. And she does it. And nobody knows ever but Rondi Bouchard and her second husband and Carrie are the only three people that know of the signing place. And Marshall Greystone found it, along with Wild Horse Sam, who was his tracker, who tracked him up the mountains and found the hiding place. But she begged him not to tell anybody where the hiding place was, and they never did. So they never found her grave. And when the mountains exploded, all the thousands of tons of dirt and rocks came down in there, it sealed her in there forever with her memories.
What a fascinating story. The place where the giant fell. It's got everything. Forbidden love, deceit, tragedy, action, adventure, danger, captivating characters, very well researched, a little bit of history as you follow the lives of these people. Just a fascinating read. The Place Where the Giant Fell. John Henry Hardy, our guest, the author. His website is jhhardy.com. John, it is always a pleasure. Excellent job with the book. You are such a master at writing, and we're going to have you back to talk about more of the books that you've written. We mentioned that you were on the program before when we talked about the first book that we had the pleasure of discussing, Whisper in My Ear. All the books are available at John's website, jhhardy.com. John, a pleasure having you with us on the program. Great story, great book. Thank you for being with us.
Well, Rick, thank you for all your flattering remarks. I just wanted the history of the Southwest to get out there, and I tried to make it into something that the kids today will read, and that teenagers will read, and that adults might be interested in reading, and learn about the early portion of the Southwest. And that was my main reason for doing that. And I tried to do it in something that, like this book, The Place Where the Giant Fell, and I tried to make it readable. And not something that was a history book.
And it is readable. If you said, I've got some history I'd like you to read, they go, yeah, I don't have time for that. I'll get to it later. You've got this fascinating story of all these great characters. And among all of that, you've got some history, the tribute to the people that you pay back in 1912 Arizona, pre-statehood for Arizona. The book, once again, is The Place Where the Giant Fell, the author John Henry Hardy. His website, jhhardy.com. You can log on directly to John's website by going to our website, thisweekinamerica.us. And we're back after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.